Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to reports, 30,000 San Francisco hotel rooms are still vacant during the COVID-19 pandemic. After months of public outcry, the Board of Supervisors called on San Francisco Mayor London Breed to immediately procure 8,250 hotel rooms for unhoused people. But as of this week, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, only 2,700 rooms have been leased. Last Thursday, community advocates staged a die-in outside of Mayor Breed's home, protesting her slow response. The advocates included a group of UCSF doctors with the Do No Harm Coalition, activists with the Coalition on Homelessness, the Solidarity Forever Collective, and the group Faith in Action. Well, the next day, two unhoused San Francisco residents, Cooper Arona and Jess Gonzalez, who are part of the group Reclaim SF, moved into a vacant investment property in the Castro. They say the property has been empty for 4 years. Just hours later, police forced them to leave. Community members immediately took to Twitter to share videos and pictures in support of Cooper Arona and Jess Gonzalez. Cooper Arona said, quote, "Whether you live in a house or you live in the streets, we're all San Francisco residents. I want our city leaders to pay attention. We are people. We are human. We need homes. We need a safe and stable place to be so we can feel like we belong again in our city." And in just a couple minutes, we will talk more about Cooper Arona's story. Joining us now are two guests. Quiver Watts is an organizer with Reclaim SF, a group of housed and unhoused community members who say they are tired of waiting for the city of San Francisco to address the immediate need for housing. They're working to open vacant units for homeless neighbors. Quiver also works as the editor of The Street Sheet, a publication of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. Hi, Quiver. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are also joined by Joe Wilson, executive director and former client of Hospitality House, a community-based organization providing opportunities, resources, and shelter for unhoused people. Hospitality House moved its clients into hotel rooms last month. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Thanks for having me. Hi, Quiver.
Good morning.
Hi, Joe.
Great to have both of you. I should say we did reach out to Mayor London Breed's office. We asked if she or anyone in her office could join us, even for a couple of minutes, but they did not get back to us. Joe, you've been on a number of times talking about this issue, and you know, every day we're just wondering what's happening. The latest numbers we have are, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, only 2,700 hotel rooms have been leased. Can you give us any updates?
Well, that is the update. It's barely 10%, not even 10% of the hotel rooms that are available. It is excruciatingly slow, and frankly, every hour we waste costs someone potentially their life. And I know that activists, friends and neighbors are getting increasingly tired of polite conversation and discussion and feeling that they need to take the struggle to the streets.
Well, and Joe, we should say, speaking of costing someone their life, Mission Local's Joe Eskenazi ran a piece on May 4th, "While the city raises the specter of invasion of out-of-town homeless, one of its own dies on the street denied a hotel room." And I'll just read from this piece. "When Ian Carrier departed this earth, he left only two items, his wheelchair and his discharge papers from the hospital. They were printed up almost exactly a week ago at 3:20 p.m. on Monday, April 27th. Mary Howe found the wheelchair, the papers, and Carrier on Hyde and Eddy one day later. He'd been dead for hours, and it was left to Mary Howe to identify the body." Mary runs the Homeless Youth Alliance in San Francisco. Joe, are you aware of this death?
Yes, I am. And it was a very painful experience for Mary. Mary has been on the ground doing this work for more than half her life, and she knew Ian Carrier for almost 20 years. It was it was excruciating for her to find him in his wheelchair, discharged from a hospital, one of the best medical centers in the country, discharged to the street, a dialysis patient, with no room at the inn for this young man, Ian Carrier. And, you know, that experience, you know, is painful for Ian's family, his friends, particularly for Mary Howe. Our heart goes out to each of them. And it should give us pause about where we are in dealing with this pandemic and the fact that there are vacant hotel rooms within blocks of tent encampments, vacant hotel rooms within blocks of homeless shelters, and vacant hotel rooms while a young man dies in a wheelchair on the street is a serious indictment for all of us, and particularly our leadership in the city.
Mission Local reports that Carrier was only 36, and I hope everyone can take some time to remember him and read about his life. We will have a link at yourcallradio.org. Joe, I just want to say that we've been inviting Mary to join us again. She runs the Homeless Youth Alliance. And from 10 to 11, she says, you know, I'd love to join you, but I'm out on the streets helping the young unhoused people in San Francisco. We're just too busy trying to get them services.
Well, you know, that's Mary Howe. She doesn't talk about much. She just does. And I know this experience has been very painful and very personal for Mary. And she has appealed to all of us to take notice of this particular death and all that's implied and realized with a young man dying in his wheelchair on the street within eyesight of City Hall. We are all in some way culpable for that. And we have, we're now erecting tent encampments with barriers that harken back to the days of internment camps. We can do better than that in the city of St. Francis. And every day, those of us in this work have to look each other in the eye. We have to look our staff members in the eye. We have to look our community members in the eye and convince them that we care about them. We have to convince them that we have their best interest at heart. And it's hard to keep saying that when all around us there is so much evidence to the contrary that we are not doing well at all in this crisis. I feel that the mayor is getting bad advice in a number of ways. And I think we really need to reset ourselves and reclaim the moral high ground in this struggle. We have absolutely lost it. And so people are tired of, again, polite conversation, polite discussion, trying to respect decision makers who are behaving disrespectfully. And we appeal to all of our city leaders to engage providers on the ground. We have lots of expertise in our homeless response system. It doesn't always feel that we're viewed as partners in this struggle. For Hospitality House, we had the opportunity with Supervisor Haney and his staff, the San Francisco United Methodist Missions, the members of Faith in Action gave us an opportunity to move a number of our shelter residents to better living accommodations. That was more than a month ago. And there were a few residents who remained in our shelter because we couldn't guarantee that they could return to the shelter after the shelter in place was lifted. But if we had waited until the city decided it was going to move those residents, we would still be waiting. And more than likely, someone could be dead by now because we waited too long to act.
Quiver, what would you add? I know that you were not at the protest in front of Mayor London Breed's home last Thursday. Livia Park, a doctoral candidate at UCSF and a member of the Do No Harm Coalition, said, quote, "I cannot stand by as our city leaders not only blatantly ignore city legislation essential to preserving public health, but also actively doing great harm. It is not uncommon for doctors to be completely heartbroken when we have to discharge someone who is unhoused back onto the streets." So, Quiver, what would you add?
Absolutely. I think that one of the important things to take stock of in this moment is that this was a crisis before COVID-19. Doctors were discharging patients onto the streets before COVID-19. We had thousands of people sleeping on the streets and in congregate shelters before the pandemic. And it was inexcusable then, but it is unconscionable now. Mayor Breed has emergency powers that allow her to open empty hotel rooms as well as vacant homes to every homeless person impacted by the coronavirus crisis. Her failure to do that is leaving thousands of people for dead on the streets, in congregate shelters, and in overcrowded SROs. So I think that one of the things that has really come out in the last week is that Mayor Breed is making a conscious and deliberate decision to leave people outside during this time. We had the Board of Supervisors unanimously pass an ordinance requiring Mayor Breed to move 8,000 people into hotel rooms. The city has currently only acquired 2,700 rooms, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, but only 1,163 of those rooms have been filled. That means the majority are being paid for, leased by the city, and sitting vacant while our neighbors are dying outside and on the streets and in congregate settings. That's unconscionable. It's inexcusable at any time, but it's unconscionable during a global pandemic. She also has the emergency powers to move people into vacant homes. There are more vacant properties in San Francisco than there are homeless people. We think that housing is a human right for all people, and that leaving people outside or offering a temporary solution is not enough. We need housing every day, not just during a global pandemic. We can end homelessness today, and we don't need to wait any longer for that to happen.
Let's talk about Reclaim SF and the organization that you're working with, and what happened last Friday. Two unhoused San Francisco residents, Cooper Arona and Jess Gonzalez, moved into a vacant investment property in the Castro. A Reclaim SF says this property has been vacant for 4 years. And just hours later, police forced them out. Now, Cooper Arona is known around San Francisco as the street medic because she bikes around helping people treat wounds and other ailments. She treats people how to use Narcan. And she became unhoused 10 years ago when she was injured as a firefighter. Tell us a little bit more about what happened with Cooper and Jess, Quiver.
Yes. As you mentioned, Cooper has been homeless for the last 10 years. She estimates about 15 years during the course of her life. Jess became homeless a year ago because her landlord evicted her for having a service animal in the home. Both of them have been sleeping in vehicles. So last Friday, they moved into a vacant property. It's an investment property that had been held vacant, actually for, we found out through the occupation, longer than 4 years. Neighbors told us it had been more like 7 or 8 years that the property had been vacant. And they walked in and claimed it as a home, and that action was really powerful, I think, because it so demonstrates what the right thing is in this moment. Two homeless women moving into a home in the middle of a pandemic to take shelter. And it also really, you know, casts in sharp relief the way that our city responds to desperate people taking basic actions to survive. Instead of allowing them to stay, using her emergency powers to turn that vacant unit over to these two women, the city responded with lines of hostile police wearing Blue Lives Matter masks on their face, who harassed the crowd of supporters that came to try and ensure that Jess and Cooper are able to stay in their home, and who eventually threatened and forced Cooper and Jess from the unit that they had turned into a home. Back in 2018, San Francisco voters passed Prop C, Our City, Our Home, with almost 62% of the vote. And that ballot initiative promised to open 4,000 units of safe and permanent housing to homeless San Franciscans. Mayor Breed has not only refused to move people into hotel rooms during this pandemic, but she has also refused to use the funds that were collected during that time or to sign a pledge that she will respect the will of the voters and fully implement Prop C. And so, you know, here in 2020, we still have not seen a single unit of permanent housing opened with the funds collected through Prop C. So Reclaim SF is dedicated to taking matters into our own hands. If Mayor Breed continues to refuse to do so, she sentences homeless people to death on the streets and in congregate settings, then it's up to us to do the right thing and open these vacant units to our homeless neighbors.
We should say that every time we do a show about unhoused people in San Francisco, we invite Mayor Breed or her office to join us for even a couple of minutes, and they never get back to us. So I should say that we try to invite them because we would really love to talk with them about this, but they are not getting back to us. I also want to add, according to Reclaim SF, Cooper Arona first moved into a tent, but her encampment was swept during the Super Bowl, and at that time she moved into an RV where she has lived since. But she's tired of worrying if her vehicle and all of her belongings will be targeted and towed, tired of living without access to a shower or a kitchen. Joe, I was really struck by something that Cooper tweeted after this went down. She wrote, well, actually it was inside the home. She said, inside our home, even if it was just a brief moment, it felt so good to feel safe.
Yes, and I would, that's a powerful statement about, what a home can bring, what four walls can bring in terms of true shelter from all the elements. It's very difficult to be able to rationalize this irrational behavior by our political leadership. Quiver is absolutely right on. 6 months before this crisis was upon us, homeless people's lives weren't viewed as worth very much. They're not viewed as worth very much right now. In a real sense, a vacant hotel room is worth more than a homeless person's life. We're concerned that 6 months on the other side of this crisis, homeless people will go back to being viewed as worthless. We are not comfortable with that. I don't think anyone should be, certainly in our human services field. People are not okay with that. And I also have to say that, it's very hard to, rationalize and reconcile this behavior on the part of the mayor's office, where, we can use the power of eminent domain when we want to construct a freeway, but not when we want to save someone's life. And that is very hard to reconcile the irreconcilable in the midst of this crisis. And I do know that there have been many heroes and heroines in this struggle. We applaud them, the first responders, the emergency workers, the people on the front lines, working in shelters, in hospitals, putting their lives on the line every minute of every day without the necessary equipment and protections that they need. We want to lift up those people in every way that we can. And I'll also, just an aside here about, blue lives mattering. Communities of color across this country are well aware of the fact that blue lives matter. Black people can get gunned down in the middle of the street, and there are no consequences for that, so we're clear on the fact that blue lives matter. But I also want to celebrate really the everyday heroes in this struggle. My heart goes out to to Ian Carrier and his family and his friends, particularly Mary Howe, who has to carry that memory with her every day now. Sister April Sloan, who shared that private struggle with us, that private pain. Hats off to Joe Eskenazi for his sensitive treatment of that incident, and applaud everyone in the struggle who is, you know, soldiering on, you know, despite so much evidence to the contrary about the quality and the efficacy of political leadership in this moment where it's needed most.
Joe Wilson is executive director and former client of Hospitality House, a community-based organization providing resources and shelter to unhoused people. Last month, Hospitality House moved its clients into hotel rooms. Quiver Watts is an organizer with Reclaim SF, a group of housed and unhoused community members who say they're tired of waiting for the city of San Francisco to address the immediate need for housing. So they're working to open vacant units for unhoused people. We did invite Mayor London Breed or someone from her office to join us, but they did not get back to us. I want to ask both of you about what we are hearing from the mayor's office. Joe, last time you were on, you responded to the comment by the mayor saying that there's so many logistics involved in this. Some people do not want to be in hotel rooms. And now what she's saying is that San Francisco residents need to be the priority. She says people from out of town are coming to San Francisco asking for a hotel room. But in the Mission Local piece, Mary Howe says the Hate is always the place people come to, but now it's not the case. I have not met one person who's come to town in the last 2 months. What's your response to these latest comments from Mayor Breed, Joe?
Well, again, the mayor's getting bad advice. And again, I mean, the fact that we would house a homeless immigrant from someplace else, you would think in the city of St. Francis that'd be a good thing. And if we house someone from someplace else and house someone from San Francisco, that's two people we get off the street. I hope that, you know, the mayor's office has an opportunity to rethink their strategy on this and to think long and hard about the difficulty in this work. There are people in this field who have devoted their lives to this work, who know very well how hard it is. You know, so welcome to our world, and we still stand ready to help the mayor through this crisis, to get everyone off the street, to get everyone tested, to devote ourselves to making sure that we are doing right by the people who we claim to represent, and give people reason to be hopeful that their lives actually do matter when it matters most, which is now. It's today. The clock is ticking. People's lives are at risk. People are dying. Let's move now.
Quiver, what would you add?
I think Joe pretty much covered it. I think you know, the idea that we would leave thousands of San Franciscans homeless or in congregate shelters rather than take the small risk of potentially saving the life of someone who wasn't born and raised in San Francisco is ludicrous. It's absolutely unconscionable. And I think, you know, we need people to be moved not just into hotel rooms, but into permanent and safe housing. Every San Franciscan deserves a home. Every homeless person deserves to be inside. And we can't wait another day.
And before we let you go, Joe, can you give us a quick update on testing in shelters? Last week, the New York Times reported that the CDC conducted a study of homeless shelters in four cities. One was San Francisco. They found that as early as March, broad testing procedures are needed among shelter staff and residents. What's the status of testing in shelters, Joe?
Finally, in the month of May, we have broader-based testing available. It took quite a while and significant advocacy and organizing on the behalf of a lot of people, notably the warriors at the Coalition on Homelessness, the medical establishment. We salute the doctors and medical professionals who have been pushing for this. You know, everyone who is in a congregate setting, in an SRO, in an unsafe housing situation, deserves that information to know the status of their health and the risks that they're facing every day. The people who are working with them deserve that information, and that access to free testing. And so we hope that the broader base of people that we test, it will give us more information to understand which living situations are most at risk, where to move people, where to identify additional resources. We can't do that absent the information to act on.
Well, we will definitely continue covering this issue. Joe Wilson is executive director and former client of Hospitality House. They moved their clients into hotel rooms last month. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Quiver Watts is an organizer with Reclaim SF, a group of housed and unhoused community members who say they are tired of waiting for the city of San Francisco to address the immediate need for housing, so they're working to open vacant units for unhoused neighbors. Quiver, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I should also say Quiver works as editor of The Street Sheet, a publication of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. We didn't have time this time around to talk about what's happening in SROs, single room occupancies, but we do know that an SRO in the Mission District confirmed that 22 residents and two staff tested positive. The Department of Homelessness has moved residents over 60 and those with underlying health conditions out of shelters and into hotel rooms. It's very difficult to physically distance in an SRO because many times bathrooms are shared and there are a lot of common spaces. So we will definitely do a show about that in the coming weeks. Coming up after a quick break, we will talk about COVID-19 outbreaks in nursing homes. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we're going to turn our attention to talk about the rampant coronavirus outbreaks in nursing homes across the country. Here in California, about one-third of all COVID-related deaths are tied to nursing facilities. A new investigation by the LA Times found that 192 of the state's skilled nursing facilities have had COVID-19 outbreaks. Their review of records found at least 13 are connected to the Plum Healthcare Group, accounting for at least 500 cases and 43 deaths. So why weren't long-term care facilities prepared? Today we're joined by two guests. Charlene Harrington is Professor Emerita of Sociology and Nursing in the School of Nursing at UCSF. Charlene studies skilled nursing facilities and long-term care. Hi, Charlene. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for including me.
Thank you. We're also joined by Arnulfo de la Cruz, Executive Vice President of SEIU Local 2015, the largest union in California, representing over 400,000 long-term care workers. Arnulfo was previously director of the SEIU's Immigrant Justice Campaign. Hi, Arnulfo. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to join.
Well, Arnulfo, let's start off with you. The deadliest outbreak so far is at the Redwood Springs Healthcare Center in Visalia. As of Thursday, 115 residents tested positive, 61 staff were infected, and tragically, 26 residents died. At Canyon Springs Post-Acute in Santa Clara County, 69 patients and 30 staff tested positive, 6 residents died. A nurse at Redwood Springs said, quote, "We were not prepared. We lost control of the situation because we weren't talking about it," end quote. Arnulfo, can you give us an update on why so many facilities across California saw such huge outbreaks? Many are still experiencing a surge in positive cases and in deaths.
Sure. And, you know, I actually remember very, very clearly a call that we had with several of our members from the Visalia facility. I think of the five members that we had on the phone call, four of them had tested positive for COVID. What I would say, which was, you know, pretty amazing, is that these four nursing home workers stayed on a conference call with their employer over the course of 4 hours, right? And they were sheltering, they were in quarantine at home, and they stayed on the phone negotiating with their employer around a set of demands. And I just want to say, too, the primary concerns that they had, I know that we're focusing specifically on the pandemic, and appropriately so. What I want to highlight is that a lot of the conditions of nursing home workers in California in the issues that we've been focusing on as a union for many, many, many years have existed in this industry for a long, long time. overlay a pandemic on top of these issues, and we get to a point where this is the spread of this virus is running rampant. So let me just share with you a couple of the concerns specifically that we heard from Vicelli and what we're hearing from others. One, the issue of staffing, which, you know, being able to have the appropriate staff to deal with the pandemic is front and center as a crisis here. We've heard multiple times that the facility was ill-prepared as it related to medical-grade PPE, ensuring that every worker in that facility had access to PPE. And when I say PPE, just in case maybe our listeners haven't heard, it's the protective personal equipment. So that's been front and center as one of their demands. Making sure that people are able to have paid time off and sick leave, right? That's a benefit. If you have symptoms or if you're symptomatic, you should be able to get some rest, not go into work. We know that limits the spread, but oftentimes people don't have benefits to access and they're losing income, and that's too difficult of a decision to be made. And then also just all of the training and education around infection control. I think many of us will ill-prepared to deal with a pandemic of this nature. So these are just a couple of lists, I think, issues that were front and center that they were raising up. And again, many of these issues have been existing in this industry for a long, long time. We know that the majority of those who nursing home workers care for tend to be low income, including the caregivers themselves, communities of color, right? So I think there's so much that we can do to provide real solutions. That's what we've been working with the state with. We've been working with our members who are on the front line. And I know we're going to be digging a little bit more, but I guess that would be my initial response.
Professor Harrington, you recently told the LA Times that nursing homes would like the public to think this just happened to them, but it didn't. You went on to say the chains were bad to begin with, and then they were just not prepared for this pandemic. According to a study you did in 2015, you found that 75% of California facilities are owned by chains, and overall about 90% of them are privately owned. So for people who are not familiar with how these nursing centers are run or who owns them, can you just give us a little 101 on this?
Well, the nursing homes are mostly for-profit, and the chains are ones that have multiple facilities under one owner. And we know that the for-profit and the chain-owned facilities have the lowest staffing, and they have the most deficiencies and the most quality problems. And basically, that's because they're trying to make money. And it's a very labor-intensive industry. And so the best way to make money is to cut the staffing, cut the wages, and cut the benefits. And they're taking a lot of profits out of the nursing homes during the year. And at the end of the year, they try to show that they have a deficit so they don't have to pay taxes. So they're profitable organizations. And particularly, they cut corners on RN staffing, but overall staffing. And so that means that many of these nursing homes have had serious violations of infection control requirements, and they have other quality problems and receive deficiencies. But the state really hasn't done much about it, so they're allowed to continue to do this year after year because our state standards are not tough enough in terms of the staffing levels.
The LA Times reports that the nursing home industry once comprised small operators, locally owned and managed, and often nonprofit, but the industry has morphed into a network of sophisticated chains with a strong lobbying presence in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. And the LA Times reports, Professor Harrington, that these chains are often owned by investors who obscure their roles through LLCs, limited liability companies, and amass dozens of properties that draw hundreds of millions in Medicare and Medicaid funds. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Well, they're financed by the government money, but the financial controls are almost minimal. And California has a minimum staffing standard, but it's way below what the professional standards should be. And so that's what allows these companies to make money, because they can make money off of the low staffing and low wages and benefits. So they're primarily in business to make money and not really to deliver care and services. So they have bad working conditions for workers and then poor quality of care. And, of course, the hospital... hospitals are mostly nonprofit, and they have much higher staffing, and they pay higher wages and benefits. But then we've allowed the long-term care industry to be taken over by these large private companies that aren't really putting patients first. So I'm hoping that this pandemic will inform people about how we've allowed this to go on for a number of years without trying to make changes.
Hmm. And the LA Times reports that this industry brings in more than $10 billion in annual revenue in California, mostly from state and federal government payments for 119,000 beds in 1,200 facilities. So $10 billion a year in annual revenue, Professor Harrington.
Yes, yes. And yet, of all the money they bring in, only about 35% of that money is spent on the nursing care and the care for the residents, which is shocking because we have such weak regulations and oversight of the industry because, as you say, they're very powerful politically, and they've been able to block any kind of substantive reform.
And they've been pressuring Governor Gavin Newsom to shield them from any liability, saying that they could be forced to close under a wave of lawsuits, taking away beds needed to relieve pressure on the hospitals. So we will follow that and bring listeners updates. Arnulfo, what are you hearing from people who work in these facilities? What are the main differences? And Professor Harrington briefly touched on this. What are the differences between the small, locally owned nursing homes and the nursing homes that are run by investors?
Yeah, I think it's exactly true, right? I think what's very clear is that there's plenty of profit being made in this industry, and what's being sacrificed is working conditions of the workers, you know, over 120,000 who are working in these skilled care facilities statewide. But this is a perfect example of profit over care. I would say across the industry, it's too easy of a decision. If I'm a certified nursing assistant in a skilled care facility, I'm having to turn and reposition bedridden patients. I'm taking people's temperature, blood pressure, other vital signs. I'm answering patient calls. I'm, you know, documenting patients' health issues. I'm reporting to the nurses. I'm feeding the patients. I'm measuring and recording, you know, food and liquid intake. I'm also helping to clean rooms and bed linens. If someone has a wound, I'm dressing those wounds. This is incredibly labor-intensive work. And then give me 10 or 11 patients on any given shift, it's almost humanly impossible. Not only that, I'm making close to minimum wage with very few benefits. So I would say, regardless of, you know, what we have seen in facilities where workers have a union, where they're able to collectively bargain and sit at the table with their employer and say, let's open up the books here. We want to see the profit that you're making. Let's talk about wages and benefits. We've seen some real progress, especially in some of the Bay Area facilities, but there's so much more work that needs to be done. I think where we feel like the solution lies is that we have to create industry standards that are broad, that are aggressive, not just to limit and bend the curve of the spread of COVID, but also to address these fundamental issues that have existed in this industry for a long, long time, because ultimately what's at stake here is the quality of care and also the working conditions of those who provide that care.
In the LA Times piece that I have been citing, a Redwood Springs nurse who wanted to remain anonymous because she fears retaliation said, quote, "There's no way I can make it on my salary. My daughter used to work at Claire's and she made more money than I did, and I need to keep a license." And I'm pretty sure she's talking about Claire's jewelry shop. Can you tell us, Arnulfo, you talked about just how difficult the work is and how consistent it is. In this case, this Redwood Springs nurse said that they spend their days rushing patient to patient. What else can you tell us just about the workload and what is average pay for someone who works in one of these nursing homes?
Yeah, and it really, you know, there actually is not a huge difference. There is slight by region, right? We see that in the Bay Area that pay generally is a little bit more, but frankly, so is the cost of living, right, than Fresno or the Central Valley or further north or parts of the Inland Empire. But I think overall, across the industry, there needs to be a significant overhaul in the way that nursing home workers are being compensated and their benefits package, because I see the question of staffing directly related also to pay and benefits. What does this industry need to do to attract that nurse, to retain that nurse that you're speaking of? What does the industry need to do to attract the future workforce of this industry? Because at the current pay, and to your question, which sometimes is right around minimum wage, and in the best case scenario, a couple dollars more, that's not attracting the need for CNAs, for laundry workers, for maintenance workers, for housekeeping, right? Those are very labor intensive jobs. If we're going to address the staffing issue in this crisis, we have to be able to address this issue of standard of living for nursing home workers, because it's all too real. There's not a nursing home worker that I don't speak to when we're on a conference call. Several of them are trying to work at multiple facilities. So it's this story, and this is not just for nursing home workers, but for too many Californians that are having to work one, two, three jobs just to make what used to be one. So it's a crisis, and it's certainly, you know, this is what we have to work and overhaul the industry, work with them, work with the state of California and our local community infrastructure to address the accountability here.
Arnulfo de la Cruz is Executive VP of SEIU Local 2015, the largest union in California representing over 400,000 long-term care workers. Charlene Harrington is Professor Emerita of Sociology and Nursing in the School of Nursing at UCSF. Professor Harrington studies skilled nursing facilities and long-term care. According to the Los Angeles Times, at least 663 residents and 11 staff at California nursing homes have died from COVID-19. That is about 31% of the deaths in this state. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. We just got an email from a retired nurse that worked as a healthcare facilities evaluator for the state. This person writes, "Long-term care facilities are primarily a success-for-profit business. Profits are the primary purpose of their existence. Facilities try and minimize the cost of staffing by paying the lowest wages possible. There are minimal requirements for utilizing trained professional staff like nurses who have the expertise to train and supervise the hardworking nursing aides. The few professional staff are working to care for a large number of patients. There are no specific staffing ratios in nursing homes now found in hospital settings. The industry has immense political power and the ability to have deficiencies and any penalties deleted in a process that does not involve the evaluators." Professor Harrington, based on the research that you have done, what are some of the systemic changes that are needed within nursing homes?
Well, I think we really need some champions in the state legislature to try to get new legislation. You know, nursing assistants should not have to take care of more than 7 residents on the daytime and the evening shifts. And if the patients are sicker, they should only have to take care of 5 residents. This is not going to happen unless we change the legislation. The registered nurses need to have specific requirements or nursing homes are not going to hire them because they cost more money. So we really need reform of the staffing law. Then secondly, we need to have much more strict financial accountability so that nursing homes can't siphon off all the money into profits and administrative costs. And so if we could make some fundamental changes, that would really improve the quality of the nursing home industry. And I'd also like to see some cities and counties really think about setting up their own nursing homes in local areas so that we wouldn't have to rely on these for-profit companies.
Hmm. Do you know of any legislation that's currently in Congress that would address some of these issues, Professor Harrington?
Well, there is a staffing bill that Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky has introduced, and that's been introduced for a number, you know, several times over the years, and it never goes anywhere. Mm. It's a lot easier to get the state staffing laws changed. And we did improve the staffing with the legislation that was passed in and started in 2018 in California, but it's still way below what the standard should have been. So we just have to go back to the legislature and say we have to get this changed.
Arnulfo, what would you add when you talk to people who work in the nursing homes, people like the nurse I cited earlier who said her daughter who works at a jewelry store makes more money than she does? Obviously, pay increases, basic benefits, and dignity. I mean, this is kind of a running theme during COVID-19 and really before, but it's really hitting people in the face right now. What other changes are you hearing from people working in nursing facilities?
The fundamental right that they should have to feel safe and healthy at work, I mean, that should be for every worker in California, but that is what's really, I think, front and center here. The question of staffing, you know, we did work and improve staffing statewide, and then the first thing that the industry did was they applied for waivers, and the waiver allowed them to skirt the new staffing regulations, and we saw that very broadly, right, for multiple employers. So I think, of course, the issues that have been mentioned by the professor are spot on. We need to create real standards around, in a pandemic, what is the responsibility of these employers to report, to provide adequate medical-grade PPE to employees? How are they communicating with nursing home workers and those that they care for, our patients in these facilities? In the midst of a pandemic, there were some instances where we had a nursing home worker, I think he was in San Jose, on a call who said, I got one pair of gloves. I used those for a week. I'm now using plastic bags with a rubber band around each of my hands, and I'm rewashing my mask. Absolutely ridiculous. And this was in a facility where the spread was increasing. So, you know, I think and then also providing resources so that all skilled nursing facilities are able to implement and provide direct trainings around infection control in accordance with OSHA standards. So there's a real, I think, free testing. If you're a nursing home worker in the state of California or a patient, you should absolutely have the right to free testing. That's currently not the case. Mm. Expediting or fast-tracking pending licenses for CNAs, I think, is also incredibly important. So there's a whole list of things, I think, that we're hearing that we have to work on to address this current crisis and beyond.
And I want to ask you both in our final minutes, just to really acknowledge and remember the people who died in these nursing homes. I mean, I can't imagine how their families are feeling and doing right now. 663 residents just in California. And this is really happening all across the country. Professor Harrington, do you have any idea how these homes or how the state are addressing the deaths of these residents in California?
Well, I think the governor has been trying to take some action, but there's still so many things that haven't been done. First of all, we need to prioritize testing for every single staff and every resident in every nursing home and assisted living facility in California. And only San Francisco and LA County are trying to do that right now. So because so many people are asymptomatic, you can't, by the time you find out that there's the virus in the home, it's too late. So we need to test everybody, and we need to make sure that all the facilities have the PPE. So we also need monitors in all of these nursing homes that have the virus, and we need to require nursing homes to increase their staffing right now. In fact, the California Department of Public Health said that the facilities don't have to even meet the current standards, which are too low. So instead of taking really strong actions to get on top of this epidemic, the public policies have not been effective. So we can expect this to continue to spread in California.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this issue, and there are many angles to cover here. Charlene Harrington is Professor Emerita of Sociology and Nursing in the School of Nursing at UCSF. She studies skilled nursing facilities and long-term care. Professor Harrington, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Arnulfo de la Cruz is Executive Vice President of SEIU Local 2015, the largest union in California, which represents over 400,000 long-term care workers. Arnulfo, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And if you are in California and you have any legal questions about what's happening in nursing homes, that will be the topic of Your Legal Rights tonight at 7 p.m. Pacific. You can listen to that show, kalw.org. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We'll be joined by award-winning health journalist Trudy Lieberman. We'll talk about the state of healthcare in the United States. It is directly connected to what we're talking about today. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.